12-month-old baby was crawling around looking for his mother. He was navigating himself around the corners and continued as one on a quest. And then when he came to me, he paused, looked at my legs for a moment, and then turned the corner. He continued to crawl until he came to the next person, looking at the legs and made an exclamation of glee. He had found Mom. The interesting part to me was that he never looked up. His head was bent on looking at the surface before him. He had a range of vision about 4 to 6 inches at the most. And as his mother and I had on similar clothing, pants, and of near the same color, navy, he paused when he came to me, moved on when he saw this was not the person he was looking for. I watched the child explore the world around him with such discrimination. He was making several brain connections of the 1,000 trillion which are expected in his first 3 years of life. He is growing in body and mind. And that's what we want for all persons. And so Charlotte Mason said, children learn to grow. Why must the child learn? Why do we eat? Is it not in order that the body may live and grow and be able to fulfill its functions? Precisely so much that the mind must be sustained and developed by means of the food convenient for him. Charlotte Mason calls it mental pablum. It is the Latin word which means foodstuff, to assimilate knowledge. Charlotte Mason used the analogy of food for the mind as food for the body. What are we eating? What are our children eating? What is their mind food? Not just in the hours of school, but in the hours of home. What are they feasting upon? Or what are they starving upon? I spent a few hours with a 12-year-old boy last spring who was working at less than an optimal place at school. To all those around him, the principal, the teacher, and the parents, he was not experiencing growth. As I sat down with him, I began to ask some questions about his relationship with school. He could readily speak about his thinking and his feelings, which is a good thing. It's hard to talk to people who have no answers. I made a chart of what he was thinking about this and that, and we already knew he struggled with writing, composing his own thoughts on paper. He disliked certain subjects, not the subject so much itself, but the response to the subject. And so, as I talked to him, he had some negative images before him, and I asked him to articulate him. And so, which we did, and when he was finished, we talked about how he could have a change in his brain. And so we talked about how he could come with a new direction to his thinking. And one of the things that he struggled with is that he had not finished an assignment at school, and a good teacher said to him, take the assignment home and finish it. And a good parent said, you need to finish this in a worthy manner. And so what was the alternative? To leave him as his nature? No, but to help him through this. He gave a few more descriptions, and I gave some comments. And with all of these, we worked to create new messages. So we decided that he could come up with some movement and a way of thinking that could change his brain. So he would do thumbs up anytime he thought about writing. So he would just indiscriminately go, thumbs up. And he often brought a smile to his face when he did that because he liked bringing his thumbs up. So giving the mother the book, You Are Not Your Brain, and helping him with these tools, he was able to grow in a way which had been quite dormant and quite negative for a while. Ideas may invest as an atmosphere, Charlotte Mason says, rather than strike as a weapon. The idea may exist in a clear, distinct, definite form as that of a circle in the mind of a geometrician, or it may be a mere instinct, a vague appetency towards something, like the impulse which fills the young poet's eyes with tears. He knows not why. To excite this appetency towards something, towards things lovely, honest, and of good report, is the earliest and most important ministry of the educator. How shall these indefinite ideas, which manifest themselves in appetency, be imparted? They are not given at set purposes, not taken at set times. They are held in the thought environment, which surrounds the child as an atmosphere which he breathes as the breath of life. And this atmosphere in which the child inspires his unconscious ideas of right living emanate from his parents. Every look of gentleness, every tone of reverence, every word of kindness, every act of help passes into his thought environment. The very atmosphere which the child breathes He does not think of these things. He may never think of them, but all his life long, they excite this vague appetency towards something out of which his actions spring. So when you think of that example, I'll share with you something from my own life. My parents never got up in the morning one morning and said, "Oh, I want to share with Mary Ellen what is it like." Okay, excuse me. I'm skipping around on my notes. Oh, I'll go to that later. All right, I'm back on track. My brain had a little mishap there. So why is atmosphere a tool in education? It's all accessible. It's all around us. It's in everything we breathe. Rodney asked you to walk around the school and to look around, and he said you'd see a different kind of atmosphere here at River Tree, and you do. It's not just in furnishings, but it's in relationships too. If you were here on a school day, you'd see the relationships with teacher and student different. You'd see the relationship with teacher, text, and student different. And so it would be a good thing to come and look at the atmosphere during a school day. So Charlotte Mason thought atmosphere was an important tool because it is all around us. And then she also knew we were wired to respond to atmosphere. Think about the things we have been learning. There's sensing and relating and thinking in this atmosphere. And our brain translates these messages into both negative and positive contexts. It is natural. It's not contrived. We had a student once who came to Ambleside in the middle of the sixth grade. He had formerly been in traditional school settings. And on one of his first days, he looked around and exclaimed, "At Ambleside, everybody is paying attention all the time." He had come before from an atmosphere that was just cultivated by passing time, getting through one subject or another, and this atmosphere was very present-minded because it was an atmosphere of attention. And so it just struck him one day, and he shouted it out. And also, atmosphere is the realm in which the Holy Spirit works. Charlotte Mason said this, "God whispers in the ear of the man who is ready in order that he may be the vehicle to carry the new knowledge to the rest of us. We will not hear the voice of God if we do not have a mind given to stillness." And I think about that with Jeffrey Schwartz. He's a vehicle that God has used and is using to carry a message to us about how he works. Atmosphere is also a tool of transport. It is a force in the formation of persons. I dare say each adult in this room has had to work or are working on changing their brains from the negative message received in varied atmosphere, be they home, school, church, or times with peers. In my home, my parents did not get up one morning and decide to instruct me in perfect living, but somehow I received that message from a tidy home, spilled milk, and good grades. I remember when I was 20, I was with a friend whose child had just spilled a glass of milk. She said, "It was an accident." I turned the word over and over again in my mind. "You mean it could not have been avoided if only you were paying attention, holding your cup rightly, or reaching correctly?" In another incident, I had a boy who skipped into my class late one morning, and in the middle of the teaching, he announced he was late because my father was in a car accident, and it was his dad's fault. There is that word again, accident. My brain said it again and again, accident. He was responsible, and it was his fault. My thinking continued with the word accident. It was not presented with deplorable shame, but as a matter of course in which all means of human persons have accidents. I was being formed by the atmosphere in a new way, and no one knew it but God and me. And so I had never thought that I didn't believe in accidents, but I didn't believe in accidents because I never had it challenged in my own life. I'd never been in an accident. I held on to my cup rightly in my home. But there were things, of course, I knew I was a sinner and I made mistakes, but I avoided accidents at all costs. And so when it came before me, even though it wasn't personal, it was in the atmosphere and I gained growth in formation because it was a tool of transport that God used in my life. Think for a moment of the atmosphere of your home, your home school, where you spend most of your time in any given week, and ask yourself what's thrown off by the relationships in that atmosphere, by mother, father, sister, brother, student, boss, principal, colleague. What's being thrown off? Charlotte Mason says, It's not an artificial environment we want. And I think sometimes as persons of faith, we've kind of put on Christianity as a veneer. We know to do right things and have right beliefs. And so we put that on in a way in which it's not natural. And so we come across a little bit maybe too rigid, too severe in our ways of relating with one another and also with children. And so listen to her description of what this atmosphere looks like. It's not an environment that these want, a set of artificial relations carefully constructed, but an atmosphere which nobody has been at pains to constitute. It is there about the child, his natural element, precisely as the atmosphere of the earth is about us. It is thrown off, as it were, from persons and things, stirred by events, sweetened by love, ventilated, kept in motion, by the regulated action of common sense. We all know the natural conditions under which a child should live, how he shares household ways with his mother, romps with his father, is teased by his brothers and petted by his sisters, is taught by his tumbles, learns self-denial by the baby's needs, the delightfulness of furniture by playing at battle and siege with sofa and table. He learns veneration for the old by the visits of his great-grandmother, how to live with his equals by the chums he gathers around him. He learns intimacy with animals from the dog and cat, delight in the fields where the buttercups grow, and greater delight in the blackberry hedges. And what tempered fusion of classes is so effective as a child's intimacy with his betters, and also with cook and housemaid, blacksmith and joiner, with everybody who comes in his way. Children have a sort of genius for this sort of general intimacy, a valuable part of their education. Care and guidance are needed, of course, lest admiring friends should make fools of them. So when you think of that atmosphere that she's just described, it's natural. It's a part of the furnishings. It's part of the people who come and go. It's part of the people who are there all the time. And it's natural. And so as we create homes and classrooms for our students and for our children, we need to think of a more natural environment. It's not natural that a home would always be tidy. It's not natural that there are never messes that don't get cleaned up right away. And so when you see it, those kinds of things, is that a child's able to deal with the mess when they see it and not be overcome with strong emotion or anxiety because things aren't done in a certain fashion. And now, a mess that's never cleaned up is not necessarily something that you want to create in an atmosphere, because then the child never knows that there's place for things. But these are the kinds of things that when we're working with children and living with them day in and day out, we create these atmospheres, we create these messages in the air, and we communicate to them by the way we respond and by what we allow and do not allow in. So we want to create an atmosphere conducive to growth. And an atmosphere conducive to growth entails both joy and rigor. It's not a passive atmosphere. It's an atmosphere where we all want to jump in, get our hands dirty, and do the work before us. We want to give attention. And so one of the first things is we need to become aware of ourselves. We just saw a slide about metacognition, meta-attention, and meta-awareness. How do you see yourself not being your true self in different situations or with different people? And so I want you to think about that. There are certain times in any given day that you begin the day. I used to say when I was principal of the first Ambleside school, I'd stand up in assembly and I'd say, I wish this moment would last forever, all day. Why? Because it was the height of my atmosphere. I was breathing in the beautiful music from the singing. We had wonderful prayers. It was wonderful to be with the teachers and students standing in there. And then when the music stopped and the day began, I went into my office and calls and notes and emails. It was just like the joy was taken right out of me at times. And so as I began to now create a different atmosphere in my principal's office, it was very different from the classroom because it was all structured in the classroom from 8:30 in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon. It was filled with wonderful text and drawing and laughing and writing and figuring and all kinds of different things. And now as a principal, most of what I dealt with was proactiveness of doing the things that I ought to do, and also the challenge of relating to all the people who came in for questions, all the people who came in for with concerns or difficulties that they were experiencing with a teacher or with a student or with me, unbeknownst to me. And as I had to relate in those ways, I had to create a different kind of atmosphere in which my brain would not be one in which it was just receiving negative brain messages. One of the things I did was I went on a 10-day silent retreat in Snowmass, Colorado at a Benedictine monastery. 10 days of silence. Could never look at your cell phone. You couldn't look at an email. You could call the person with whom your husband or a friend and say, I've arrived, so that no one would worry. But they asked you not to call or contact anyone. We had to get up at, well, you had to be somewhere at 4 a.m., so you had to get up a little bit earlier than that. And the day began in a very structured way. And a little bit like Jeffrey Schwartz was saying, is that you begin with this kind of systematic way of counting because you need the structure before you can get rid of the structure. And so the day was filled with much structure. I felt like I was on top of a mountain, and I was, literally, but also figuratively, I was on top of a mountain because I was at a place where it was wonderful to bathe in the silence. Now, what the silence revealed to me is I became aware, very aware, of all the things going through my mind all the time, all the time. And they were senseless things. I mean, they were senseless things like a flint of dust passing by. I'm thinking about packing my suitcase after the 10-day retreat. All these kinds of things that were going through my mind and trying to interrupt the space that I had claimed in a physical way, and we began to know what I was doing with them. Well, in the course of a day which you're busy as a principal, a teacher, a mom, or a dad at your work, you're not going to have the luxury of having 10 days of silence to figure yourself out. And then after the 10 days of silence, it was interesting because I went into the Aspen airport, and when I went into the Aspen airport, it all hit me, the world in its fullness. And I was just like, ah! And I thought, well, I'm back. And as I began to acclimate myself back, I realized that I can implement some of the things that I learned there in a time of quiet. And so there's an awareness that we all need. And every time I used to get a little stress or a kind of anxiety, or as some books talk about, as you live on cortisol, it's just that at a very high level all the time. And when I felt that, I would find a little chair in a place, and I would sit down low, and I would just sit and think about what I was thinking, what I could do about it, usually nothing. And then I began to think, okay, God, I need your help. I need your power through this. And I had to create that atmosphere for myself, because if I were to engage with you or with the student, it wouldn't be my true self they were engaging with. They would begin engaging with the anxious Mary Ellen, the Mary Ellen who was concerned about this and this and this and this and this. And as a result of that, I wouldn't come before you in the way that you truly needed me to come, as a person, not as someone who is clamorous with my own agenda. And so I say that because we might not know these things if we're just always busy. And so it's a good practice to, when you're feeling kind of that uptightness or in a hurry, we have all these things to do, is just take a second, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and be good to yourself and think about what you're thinking. It's important that you know that when you're under that kind of stress, whether you receive negative brain messages or not, I think you probably always would probably receive negative brain messages under stress. Or if you're just neutral, you're just kind of dumb and numb, you're just okay, you're just in a neutral state, is that you can't relate to anyone or the world around you in an optimal way in these conditions. So when you feel that way of stress, or you feel that way of being negative or neutral, that you're not relating to anyone. You're not good to yourself or to anyone else around you. And so it's important that you are aware of that. And a common response to this poor brain function is to avoid or accommodate the persons and things which bring us stress. Sometimes we get the idea, if only so-and-so were in my life, it would be so much easier. But then Charlotte Mason talks about how sometimes we have this neighbor in our life who just acts as a person who's going to cause us to grow in ways we might not thought of. And we all have those neighbors in our lives where people come, and they might come in the way of a 2-year-old, or they might come in the way of an 80-year-old, or they might come in the way of just our negative brain messages. But how do we respond to these stressful situations to maintain our own personal well-being and be attuned with the Spirit of God? So to create this atmosphere of growth, become aware of yourself and then become aware of your brain, and then examine your thought environment. What are the ideas that pass into your thought environment? And I want to share with you about, Charlotte Mason gave this thought about the ideas in the thought environment. She said, let the young people feel that the happiness of home is a trust which every member of it has in charge. That the child who sits down to table with a sullen face destroys for the time the happiness of his whole family, just as a hand's breadth held close to the eyes will shut out the whole light of the sun. What is it that makes the happiness of every day great treats, great successes, great delights? No, but constant friendly looks and tones in those about us, their interest and help in our pursuits, their service and pity when we are in difficulty and trouble. No home can be happy if a single member of it allows himself in ugly tempers and bad behaviors. By degrees, great sensitivity to the moral atmosphere of the home will be required. But the happiness of a single day will come to be regarded as a costly vase which any clumsy touch may overthrow. Now the attention is taken off self and its claims and fixed upon brother and sister, father and mother, servants and neighbors. So slight a thing as a friendly look can add to the happiness of one of these. Sometimes in a classroom, in a work situation, in a home, we have a person who comes to the table in this sullen manner or comes in a way that is disruptive to the atmosphere. You know, it's in a sense, I've actually heard sometimes people say in a classroom when so-and-so was absent, everything was so much better. So what can we do instead of ask the student to leave the school is we can help grow that child up. I've heard of parents who've done this in just little ways like this. You know, why don't you go back upstairs into your room and then come back down in a happy way? A child who comes into a classroom and says, ugh, it's time for math. Say, you know, why don't you reframe that? Oh, it's time for math. How about trying that again? It's time for math? Okay. You know, they need help in changing their brain. And there's a sense that we kind of ignore it. We say, oh, it doesn't really matter. I was in a situation the other day where the teacher asked for volunteers. And it was a class about maybe 12 or 14, and three girls raised their hand. And I happened to be in the class, and sometimes I take the idea of, or take the opportunity to instruct in that way. And so I said to them, I said, what does it say about the rest of you that when someone asked for volunteers, only three people raised their hand? And they all kind of sheepishly looked, you know, down, et cetera. And I said, no, really, what does it say about the rest of you? And one person said, we don't want to help. I said, well, I'm not sure what it says about you. Is that what you think? Yes. Okay, I said, so what kind of person do you want to be? Do you want to be a person who doesn't want to help, who passively goes through life, not doing the things that they ought? So let's try that again. I said to the teacher, let's ask for volunteers, and then everybody's hand went up. And you say, well, some personalities are given to helping more. They're service-oriented. Maybe that's their spiritual gift. And so we have ways of kind of cloaking these things and these ideas, which really, truly, Charlotte Mason would say, it's the responsibility of everybody to serve and to lead. And so it's not just to the ones who are willing or it is their habit to do so, raise their hand, but it is really for all persons. And so little ways of training ourselves and our children, and I try to do some of the rehearsing too, sometimes especially when I talk to my husband, because it's, you know, and so I might come back 3 minutes later and say, oh, can I say that again? Because now I'm in my better self and I think I'd like to practice with you. And he enjoys that because he knows that, you know, that wasn't my best self, and he now experienced the real and the true self. And so those are ways in which we can all grow up, because we live in a place where we have a lot of clamor. And even in a peaceful life that we've all tried to construct in our schools, in our classrooms, in our homes, and in our homeschool classrooms, and even at work or when you're in your car, we sometimes have things that kind of flit in and flit out of our lives and our minds that we need to deal with. And the other thing is, in an atmosphere, be an inspirer. When I started reading Charlotte Mason, I asked my mother one day, I said, why didn't you ever read to us? And she said, I never really thought of it. And so I thought, wow, I missed all these children's books because you didn't read to us. But what I did gain from my home was this. Both my father and my mother loved books. They were all around us. In fact, they were all reading all the time. My mom loved to write down little notes, and both my parents have died, and I have a little book of all my mom's little notes that she has written. And so I look back on that book, and she has written verses in there, quotes from the different books that she has read. And so that's a real joy for me. But when I was in about fifth grade, my dad gave me a book, and it was a biography, and it was of Sam Houston. And we weren't even from Texas. But he gave me that biography, and it just struck me when I was in fifth grade that my dad thought I could read a book that he was reading. And forever I've loved biographies because of that. But my parents were an inspirer by the way they lived their lives and how they spent their time in reading good books, and also by encouraging us to read good books. And so we have a family that pretty much reads instead of passing time through watching television and those kinds of activities. And I can attribute that to my parents. And so I put that in there that my parents didn't read to us because sometimes we think we have to do it all. Oh, I have to read a story a night. I have to have good books in the house. They need to see me reading books that I do. Well, we can't always do everything. And so what you do does make a difference. And so I just wanted to end with this, is that the challenge before us, Charlotte Mason would say, is there's no way of escape for parents or teachers. They must need the inspirers to their children, because about them hangs, as it is, an atmosphere around a planet, this thought environment of the child from which he derives those enduring ideas which express themselves as a lifelong attitude towards things sordid or things lovely, things earthly or things divine. A 12-month-old baby was crawling around looking for his mother. He was navigating himself around the corners and continued as one on a quest. And then when he came to me, he paused, looked at my legs for a moment, and then turned the corner. He continued to crawl until he came to the next person, looking at the legs and made an exclamation of glee. He had found Mom. The interesting part to me was that he never looked up. His head was bent on looking at the surface before him. He had a range of vision about 4 to 6 inches at the most. And as his mother and I had on similar clothing, pants, and of near the same color, navy, he paused when he came to me, moved on when he saw this was not the person he was looking for. I watched the child explore the world around him with such discrimination. He was making several brain connections of the 1,000 trillion which are expected in his first 3 years of life. He is growing in body and mind. And that's what we want for all persons. And so Charlotte Mason said, children learn to grow. Why must the child learn? Why do we eat? Is it not in order that the body may live and grow and be able to fulfill its functions? Precisely so much that the mind must be sustained and developed by means of the food convenient for him. Charlotte Mason calls it mental pablum. It is the Latin word which means foodstuff, to assimilate knowledge. Charlotte Mason used the analogy of food for the mind as food for the body. What are we eating? What are our children eating? What is their mind food? Not just in the hours of school, but in the hours of home. What are they feasting upon? Or what are they starving upon? I spent a few hours with a 12-year-old boy last spring who was working at less than an optimal place at school. To all those around him, the principal, the teacher, and the parents, he was not experiencing growth. As I sat down with him, I began to ask some questions about his relationship with school. He could readily speak about his thinking and his feelings, which is a good thing. It's hard to talk to people who have no answers. I made a chart of what he was thinking about this and that, and we already knew he struggled with writing, composing his own thoughts on paper. He disliked certain subjects, not the subject so much itself, but the response to the subject. And so, as I talked to him, he had some negative images before him, and I asked him to articulate him. And so, which we did, and when he was finished, we talked about how he could have a change in his brain. And so we talked about how he could come with a new direction to his thinking. And one of the things that he struggled with is that he had not finished an assignment at school, and a good teacher said to him, take the assignment home and finish it. And a good parent said, you need to finish this in a worthy manner. And so what was the alternative? To leave him as his nature? No, but to help him through this. He gave a few more descriptions, and I gave some comments. And with all of these, we worked to create new messages. So we decided that he could come up with some movement and a way of thinking that could change his brain. So he would do thumbs up anytime he thought about writing. So he would just indiscriminately go, thumbs up. And he often brought a smile to his face when he did that because he liked bringing his thumbs up. So giving the mother the book, You Are Not Your Brain, and helping him with these tools, he was able to grow in a way which had been quite dormant and quite negative for a while. Ideas may invest as an atmosphere, Charlotte Mason says, rather than strike as a weapon. The idea may exist in a clear, distinct, definite form as that of a circle in the mind of a geometrician, or it may be a mere instinct, a vague appetency towards something, like the impulse which fills the young poet's eyes with tears. He knows not why. To excite this appetency towards something, towards things lovely, honest, and of good report, is the earliest and most important ministry of the educator. How shall these indefinite ideas, which manifest themselves in appetency, be imparted? They are not given at set purposes, not taken at set times. They are held in the thought environment, which surrounds the child as an atmosphere which he breathes as the breath of life. In this atmosphere in which the child inspires his unconscious ideas of right living emanate from his parents. Every look of gentleness, every tone of reverence, every word of kindness, every act of help passes into his thought environment. The very atmosphere which the child breathes, he does not think of these things. He may never think of them, but all his life long, they excite this vague appetency towards something out of which his actions spring. So when you think of that example, I'll share with you something from my own life. My parents never got up in the morning one morning and said, oh, I want to share with Mary Ellen what is it like. okay, excuse me. I'm skipping around on my notes. Oh, I'll go to that later. All right, I'm back on track. My brain had a little mishap there. So why is atmosphere a tool in education? It's all accessible. It's all around us. It's in everything we breathe. Rodney asked you to walk around the school and to look around, and he said you'd see a different kind of atmosphere here at Rivertree, and you do. It's not just in furnishings, but it's in relationships too. If you were here on a school day, you'd see the relationships with teacher and student different. You'd see the relationship with teacher, text, and student different. And so it would be a good thing to come and look at the atmosphere during a school day. So Charlotte Mason thought atmosphere was an important tool because it is all around us, and then she also knew we were wired to respond to atmosphere. Think about the things we have been learning. There's sensing and relating and thinking in this atmosphere, and our brain translates these messages into both negative and positive contexts. It is natural. It's not contrived. We had a student once who came to Ambleside in the middle of the sixth grade. He had formerly been in traditional school settings. And on one of his first days, he looked around and exclaimed, at Ambleside, everybody is paying attention all the time. He had come before from an atmosphere that was just cultivated by passing time, getting through one subject or another. And this atmosphere was very present-minded because it was an atmosphere of attention. And so it just struck him one day and he shouted it out. And also, atmosphere is the realm in which the Holy Spirit works. Charlotte Mason said this, God whispers in the ear of the man who is ready in order that he may be the vehicle to carry the new knowledge to the rest of us. We will not hear the voice of God if we do not have a mind given to stillness. And I think about that with Jeffrey Schwartz. He's a vehicle that God has used and is using to carry a message to us about how he works. Atmosphere is also a tool of transport. It is a force in the formation of persons. I dare say each adult in this room has had to work or are working on changing their brains from the negative message received in varied atmosphere, be they home, school, church, or times with peers. In my home, my parents did not get up one morning and decide to instruct me in perfect living, but somehow I received that message from a tidy home, spilled milk, and good grades. I remember when I was 20, I was with a friend whose child had just spilled a glass of milk. She said, it was an accident. I turned the word over and over again in my mind. You mean it could not have been avoided if only you were paying attention, holding your cup rightly, or reaching correctly? In another incident, I had a boy who skipped into my class late one morning, and in the middle of the teaching, he announced he was late because my father was in a car accident, and it was his dad's fault. There is that word again, accident. My brain said it again and again, accident. He was responsible, and it was his fault. My thinking continued with the word accident. It was not presented with deplorable shame, but as a matter of course in which all means of human persons have accidents. I was being formed by the atmosphere in a new way, and no one knew it but God and me. And so I had never thought that I didn't believe in accidents, but I didn't believe in accidents because I never had it challenged in my own life. I'd never been in an accident. I held on to my cup rightly in my home. But there were things, of course, I knew I was a sinner and I made mistakes, but I avoided accidents at all costs. And so when it came before me, even though it wasn't personal, it was in the atmosphere, and I gained growth in formation because it was a tool of transport that God used in my life. Think for a moment of the atmosphere of your home, your home school, where you spend most of your time in any given week, and ask yourself, what's thrown off by the relationships in that atmosphere? By mother, father, sister, brother, student, boss, principal, colleague. What's being thrown off? Charlotte Mason says, it's not an artificial environment we want. And I think sometimes as persons of faith, we've kind of put on Christianity as a veneer. We know to do right things and have right beliefs. And so we put that on in a way in which it's not natural. And so we come across a little bit maybe too rigid, too severe in our ways of relating with one another and also with children. And so listen to her description of what this atmosphere looks like. It's not an environment that these want, a set of artificial relations carefully constructed, but an atmosphere which nobody has been at pains to constitute. It is there about the child, his natural element, precisely as the atmosphere of the earth is about us. It is thrown off, as it were, from persons and things, stirred by events, sweetened by love, ventilated, kept in motion by the regulated action of common sense. We all know the natural conditions under which a child should live, how he shares household ways with his mother, romps with his father, is teased by his brothers and petted by his sisters, is taught by his tumbles, learns self-denial by the baby's needs, the delightfulness of furniture, by playing at battle and siege with sofa and table. He learns veneration for the old by the visits of his great-grandmother, how to live with his equals by the chums he gathers around him. He learns intimacy with animals from the dog and cat, delight in the fields where the buttercups grow, and greater delight in the blackberry hedges. And what tempered fusion of classes is so effective as a child's intimacy with his betters and also with cook and housemaid, blacksmith and joiner, with everybody who comes in his way. Children have a sort of genius for this sort of general intimacy, a valuable part of their education. Care and guidance are needed, of course, lest admiring friends should make fools of them. So when you think of that atmosphere that she's just described, it's natural. It's a part of the furnishing. It's part of the people who come and go. It's part of the people who are there all the time. And it's natural. And so as we create homes and classrooms for our students and for our children, we need to think of a more natural environment. It's not natural that a home would always be tidy. It's not natural that there are never messes that don't get cleaned up right away. And so when you see it, those kinds of things, is that a child's able to deal with the mess when they see it and not be overcome with strong emotion or anxiety because things aren't done in a certain fashion. And now, a mess that's never cleaned up is not necessarily something that you want to create in an atmosphere, because then the child never knows that there's place for things. But these are the kinds of things that when we're working with children and living with them day in and day out, we create these atmosphere, we create these messages in the air, and we communicate to them by the way we respond and by what we allow and do not allow in. So we want to create an atmosphere conducive to growth. And an atmosphere conducive to growth entails both joy and rigor. It's not a passive atmosphere. It's an atmosphere where we all want to jump in, get our hands dirty, and do the work before us. We want to give attention. And so one of the first things is we need to become aware of ourselves. We just saw a slide about metacognition, meta-attention, and meta-awareness. How do you see yourself not being your true self in different situations or with different people? And so I want you to think about that. There are certain times in any given day that you begin the day. I used to say when I was principal of the first Ambleside school, I'd stand up in assembly and I'd say, I wish this moment would last forever, all day. Why? Because it was the height of my atmosphere. I was breathing in the beautiful music from the singing. We had wonderful prayers. It was wonderful to be with the teachers and students standing in there. And then when the music stopped and the day began, I went into my office and calls and notes and emails. It was just like the joy was taken right out of me at times. And so as I began to now create a different atmosphere in my principal's office, it was very different from the classroom because it was all structured in the classroom from 8:30 in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon. It was filled with wonderful text and drawing and laughing and writing and figuring and all kinds of different things. And now as a principal, most of what I dealt with was proactiveness of doing the things that I ought to do, and also the challenge of relating to all the people who came in for questions, all the people who came in with concerns or difficulties that they were experiencing with a teacher or with a student or with me, unbeknownst to me. And as I had to relate in those ways, I had to create a different kind of atmosphere in which my brain would not be one in which it was just receiving negative brain messages. One of the things I did was I went on a 10-day silent retreat in Snowmass, Colorado at a Benedictine monastery. 10 days of silence. Could never look at your cell phone. You couldn't look at an email. You could call the person with whom your husband or a friend and say, I've arrived, so that no one would worry. But they asked you not to call or contact anyone. We had to get up you had to be somewhere at 4 a.m., so you had to get up a little bit earlier than that. And the day began in a very structured way. And a little bit like Jeffrey Schwartz was saying, is that you begin with this kind of systematic way of counting because you need the structure before you can get rid of the structure. And so the day was filled with much structure. I felt like I was on top of a mountain, and I was, literally, but also figuratively, I was on top of a mountain because I was at a place where it was wonderful to bathe in the silence. Now, what the silence revealed to me is I became aware, very aware, of all the things going through my mind all the time, all the time. And they were senseless things. I mean, they were senseless things like a flint of dust passing by. I'm thinking about packing my suitcase after the 10-day retreat. All these kinds of things that were going through my mind and trying to interrupt the space that I had claimed in a physical way, and we began to know what I was doing with them. Well, in the course of a day which you're busy as a principal, a teacher, a mom, or a dad at your work, you're not going to have the luxury of having 10 days of silence to figure yourself out. And then after the 10 days of silence, it was interesting because I went into the Aspen Airport And when I went into the Aspen airport, it all hit me, the world in its fullness. And I was just like, ah! And I thought, well, I'm back. And as I began to acclimate myself back, I realized that I can implement some of the things that I learned there in a time of quiet. And so there's an awareness that we all need. And every time I used to get a little stress or a kind of anxiety, or as some books talk about, as you live on cortisol, it's just at a very high level all the time. And when I felt that, I would find a little chair in a place, and I would sit down low, and I would just sit and think about what I was thinking, what I could do about it, usually nothing. And then I began to think, okay, God, I need your help. I need your power through this. And I had to create that atmosphere for myself, because if I were to engage with you or with the student, it wouldn't be my true self they were engaging with. They would begin engaging with the anxious Mary Ellen, the Mary Ellen who was concerned about this and this and this and this and this. And as a result of that, I wouldn't come before you in the way that you truly needed me to come as a person, not as someone who is clamorous with my own agenda. And so I say that because we might not know these things if we're just always busy. And so it's a good practice to, when you're feeling kind of that uptightness or in a hurry, we have all these things to do, is just take a second, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and be good to yourself and think about what you're thinking. It's important that you know that when you're under that kind of stress, whether you receive negative brain messages or not, I think you probably receive negative brain messages under stress. Or if you're just neutral, you're just kind of dumb and numb, you're just okay, you're just in a neutral state, is that you can't relate to anyone or the world around you in an optimal way in these conditions. So when you feel that way of stress, or you feel that way of being negative or neutral, that you're not relating to anyone. You're not good to yourself or to anyone else around you. And so it's important that you are aware of that. And a common response to this poor brain function is to avoid or accommodate the persons and things which bring us stress. Sometimes we get the idea, if only so-and-so weren't in my life, it would be so much easier. But then Charlotte Mason talks about how sometimes we have this neighbor in our life who just acts as a person who's going to cause us to grow in ways we might not thought of. And we all have those neighbors in our lives where people come, and they might come in the way of a 2-year-old, or they might come in the way of an 80-year-old, or they might come in the way of just our negative brain messages. But how do we respond to these stressful situations to maintain our own personal well-being and be attuned with the Spirit of God? So to create this atmosphere of growth, become aware of yourself, and then become aware of your brain, and then examine your thought environment. What are the ideas that pass into your thought environment? And I want to share with you about, Charlotte Mason gave this thought about the ideas in the thought environment. She said, let the young people feel that the happiness of home is a trust which every member of it has in charge. That the child who sits down to table with a sullen face destroys for the time the happiness of his whole family, just as a hand's breadth held close to the eyes will shut out the whole light of the sun. What is it that makes the happiness of every day great treats, great successes, great delights? No, but constant friendly looks and tones in those about us, their interest and help in our pursuits, their service and pity when we are in difficulty and trouble. No home can be happy if a single member of it allows himself in ugly tempers and bad behaviors. By degrees, great sensitivity to the moral atmosphere of the home will be required. But the happiness of a single day will come to be regarded as a costly vase which any clumsy touch may overthrow. Now the attention is taken off self and its claims and fixed upon brother and sister, father and mother, servants and neighbors. So slight a thing as a friendly look can add to the happiness of one of these. Sometimes in a classroom, in a work situation, in a home, we have a person who comes to the table in this sullen manner, or comes in a way that is disruptive to the atmosphere. You know, it's in a sense, I've actually heard sometimes people say in a classroom when so-and-so was absent, everything was so much better. So what can we do instead of ask the student to leave the school is we can help grow that child up. I've heard of parents who've done this in just little ways like this. You know, why don't you go back upstairs into your room and then come back down in a happy way? A child who comes into a classroom and says, "Ugh, it's time for math." Say, you know, why don't you reframe that? "Oh, it's time for math. How about trying that again? It's time for math. Okay." You know, they need help in changing their brain. And there's a sense that we kind of ignore it. We say, "Oh, it doesn't really matter." I was in a situation the other day where the teacher asked for volunteers. And there was a class about maybe 12 or 14, and three girls raised their hand. And I happened to be in the class, and sometimes I take the idea of, or take the opportunity to instruct in that way. And so I said to them, I said, "What does it say about the rest of you that when someone asked for volunteers, only three people raised their hand?" And they all kind of sheepishly looked, you know, down, et cetera. And I said, "No, really, what does it say about the rest of you?" And one person said, "We don't want to help." I said, "Well, I'm not sure what it says about you. Is that what you think?" "Yes." "Okay," I said, "so what kind of person do you want to be? Do you want to be a person who doesn't want to help, who passively goes through life, not doing the things that they ought? So let's try that again." I said to the teacher, "Let's ask for volunteers." And then everybody's hand went up. And you say, well, some personalities are given to helping more. They're service-oriented. Maybe that's their spiritual gift. And so we have ways of kind of cloaking these things and these ideas, which really, truly, Charlotte Mason would say, it's the responsibility of everybody to serve and to lead. And so it's not just to the ones who are willing or it is their habit to do so, raise their hand, but it is really for all persons. And so little ways of training ourselves and our children, and I try to do some of the rehearsing too, sometimes especially when I talk to my husband, because it's, you know, and so I might come back 3 minutes later and say, "Oh, can I say that again? Because now I'm in my better self and I think I'd like to practice with you." And he enjoys that because he knows that, you know, that wasn't my best self, and he now experienced the real and the true self. And so those are ways in which we can all grow up, because we live in a place where we have a lot of clamor. And even in a peaceful life that we've all tried to construct in our schools, in our classrooms, in our homes, and in our homeschool classrooms, and even at work or when you're in your car, we sometimes have things that kind of flit in and flit out of our lives and our minds that we need to deal with. And the other thing is, in an atmosphere, be an inspirer. When I started reading Charlotte Mason, I asked my mother one day, I said, "Why didn't you ever read to us?" And she said, "I never really thought of it." And so I thought, wow, I missed all these children's books because you didn't read to us. But what I did gain from my home was this. Both my father and my mother loved books. They were all around us. In fact, they were all reading all the time. My mom loved to write down little notes. And both my parents have died. And I have a little book of all my mom's little notes that she has written. And so I look back on that book, and she has written verses in there, quotes from the different books that she has read. And so that's a real joy for me. But when I was in about fifth grade, my dad gave me a book, and it was a biography, and it was of Sam Houston. And we weren't even from Texas. But he gave me that biography, and it just struck me when I was in fifth grade that my dad thought I could read a book that he was reading. And forever I've loved biographies because of that. But my parents were an inspirer by the way they lived their lives and how they spent their time in reading good books, and also by encouraging us to read good books. And so we have a family that pretty much reads instead of passing time through watching television and those kinds of activities. And I can attribute that to my parents. And so I put that in there that my parents didn't read to us, because sometimes we think we have to do it all. Oh, I have to read a story a night. I have to have good books in the house. They need to see me reading books that I do. Well, we can't always do everything. And so what you do does make a difference. And so I just wanted to end with this, is that the challenge before us, Charlotte Mason would say, is there's no way of escape for parents or teachers. They must need the inspirers to their children, because about them hangs, as it is, an atmosphere around a planet, this thought environment of the child from which he derives those enduring ideas which express themselves as a lifelong attitude towards things sordid or things lovely, things earthly or things divine.